Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 61, special COVID-19 edition number 9, but who's counting? It's Friday, May 8th. I am coming to you from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, which still looks eerily like my den, as I shelter in place. I hope you are staying safe, protecting yourself and others. Thank you for listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 LPFM. The LP stands for low power, but where we act radio, we consider ourselves also high power, right here in Toledo. Just for the Health of It aspires to be the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Just for the Health of It has been making public health contagious since 2019. This is the unsanitized report. Well, Donald Trump has been up to his usual antics, throwing a fit when a staffer physically close to him tested positive, and burying detailed CDC guidance to help reopening efforts with at least a modicum of safety and a minimum of confusion. Let's start with a hissy fit. This from CNN. One of Trump's personal valets has tested positive for coronavirus. A member of the U.S. Navy who serves as one of President Donald Trump's personal valets has tested positive for coronavirus, raising concerns about the president's possible exposure to the virus. The valets are members of an elite military unit dedicated to the White House and often work very close to the president and the first family. Trump was upset when he was informed Wednesday that the valet had tested positive, and the president was subsequently tested again by the White House physician. The CDC says that people who feel healthy but recently had close contact with a person with COVID-19 should stay home and monitor their health. They should quarantine by staying home until 14 days after their last exposure and should check their temperature twice a day and watch for symptoms. The CDC also recommends they stay away from people who are at higher risk of becoming very ill. The White House did not say whether Trump would adhere to those guidelines after his valet tested positive. Well, folks, should not be surprised. I know he's trying to draw the circle around him tight by testing staff close to him every single day, and he's been tested multiple times now. I don't know if he's being tested every single day, but he was tested immediately after this. But the thing is, the world that he lives in and the neighborhood that he lives in, Washington, D.C., has actually tripled the amount of cases of known infections than the national rate. So, with that, is it surprising at all that, this from CNN, Pence's press secretary tests positive for coronavirus? President Donald Trump confirmed today that Vice President Mike Pence's press secretary, Katie Miller, tested positive for the coronavirus. The president said that Miller had not come into contact with him, but noted that she has been in contact with Pence. Katie Miller is married to Trump's senior advisor, Stephen Miller. Editorial note, you might want to pay attention to the social networks and the fact that this virus runs along them. It's hard to completely social distance, Donald. So we'll see what he tries to do in the meantime. But back to the story. Trump said before traveling aboard Air Force One earlier this week that he was not concerned about being in close quarters with other people since those around him are regularly tested. But a negative test and lack of symptoms are not sure signs that someone can't spread the virus. Doctors say the incubation period for the coronavirus varies, The incubation period is the time it takes from when you are exposed to the virus to developing symptoms. It ranges anywhere from 2 to 14 days. The average incubation period is estimated to be 5 days, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. During a recent trip to the Mayo Clinic, Pence did not wear a face mask, despite being told about the clinic's policy saying they are required. Pence told reporters that he wasn't wearing a mask because he's often tested for coronavirus. But a few days later, Pence said that he should have worn a mask. Trump also declined to wear a mask this week during portions of his tour of a mask-making facility in Arizona. Well, maybe they didn't have a mask. Next up, this from AP News. Trump administration buries detailed CDC advice on reopening. The Trump administration shelved a document created by the nation's top disease investigators with step-by-step advice to local authorities on how and when to reopen restaurants and other public places during the still-raging coronavirus outbreak. The 17-page report by a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention team, titled Guidance for Implementing the Opening Up America Again Framework, was researched and written to help faith leaders, business owners, educators, and state and local health officials as they begin to reopen. It was supposed to be published last Friday, but agency scientists were told the guidance, quote, would never see the light of day, according to a CDC official. The official was not authorized to talk to reporters and spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity. The AP obtained a copy from a second federal official who was not authorized to release it. The guidance was described in AP stories last week prior to the White House decision to shelve it. The Trump administration has been closely controlling the release of guidance and information during the pandemic, spurred by a new coronavirus that scientists are still trying to understand, and with the president himself leading freewheeling daily briefings until last week. Traditionally, it's been the CDC's role to give the public and local officials guidance and science-based information during public health crises. During this one, however, the CDC has not had a regular pandemic-related news briefing in nearly 2 months. CDC Director Dr. Robert Redfield has been a member of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, but largely absent from public appearances. The dearth of real-time public information from the nation's experts has struck many current and former government officials as dangerous. CDC has always been the public health agency Americans turn to in a time of crisis, said Dr. Howard Koh, a Harvard professor and former health official in the Obama administration during the H1N1 swine flu pandemic in 2009. The standard in the crisis is to turn to them for the latest data and latest guidance and the latest press briefing. That has not occurred, and everyone sees that. The Trump administration has instead sought to put the onus on states to handle COVID-19 response. This approach to managing the pandemic has been reflected in President Donald Trump's public statements, from the assertion that he isn't responsible for the country's lackluster early testing efforts to his description last week of the federal government's role as a, quote, supplier of last resort for states in need of testing aid. The reopening guidance was described by one of the federal officials as a touchstone document that was to be used as a blueprint for other groups inside the CDC who are creating the same type of instructional materials for other facilities. The guidance contained detailed advice for making site-specific decisions related to reopening schools, restaurants, summer camps, churches, daycare centers, and other institutions. It has been widely shared within the CDC and included detailed decision trees, flowcharts to be used by local officials who think through different scenarios. Well, of course, we had another flip-flop this week when Donald Trump first said, we're getting rid of the coronavirus task force, and then within 24 hours realized that all of a sudden everybody loves his task force and maybe we'll keep it indefinitely, probably for all 20 years of his presidency.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, let's take a look at our local situation here in Toledo, Lucas County, and Ohio. Lucas County's case rate is about double the state's rate and about the same as the national rate. Lucas County's death rate is 3.3 times the state rate and over 50% higher than the national death rate. In the last week, the epidemic in Toledo-Lucas County has worsened relative to both Ohio and the nation as a whole. There is little evidence of any sustained decline in cases or deaths in Toledo or Ohio as a whole. The most stunning example of this profound steadiness over the last 2 weeks are the number of Ohioans hospitalized for COVID-19, the number of Ohioans in intensive care, and the number of Ohioans on ventilators for COVID-19. If locally or statewide we were following even the weak and sketchy federal guidance, we would not be reopening businesses. Lucas County has the highest number of deaths of any Ohio county, even though we are only the fifth most populous county. These local deaths have skyrocketed in the last couple of weeks. This begs the question, why is Ohio reopening businesses? Why is Lucas County reopening businesses?
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times. But I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, let's get back to states reopening. A Harvard study says that only 9 states are ready to begin reopening safely. Ohio is not one of them, nor are any of our neighboring states, Michigan, Indiana, Pennsylvania, or Kentucky, all of which are beginning reopening. Let's look at the full story. This from The Hill. Harvard study says only 9 states ready to safely reopen. The only 9 states are running enough COVID-19 tests to contain their outbreaks and reopen by May 15th, according to a Harvard NPR analysis released Thursday. Those 9 states also would need to be tracing and isolating positive cases and their contacts in order to open safely by May 15th. The states meeting that criteria are Alaska, Hawaii, Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, Tennessee, Utah, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Those states have enough testing to test all infected people and their close contacts who may have been exposed to the virus. Those states are also seeing 10% or less of their tests coming back positive. meaning they are likely casting a wide enough net to finding new infections, according to recommendations from the World Health Organization. The more people who are tested for the coronavirus, the lower the positivity rate is expected to be. But states with much larger populations and bigger COVID-19 outbreaks, including New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, are running far fewer tests than are needed to lift some physical distancing restrictions by May 15th. While governors in those states are moving more slowly towards reopening, states that are already lifting restrictions, including Georgia, Texas, and Colorado, are also far from meeting the minimum testing target set by Harvard. The numbers are sobering. Overall, our need for testing has only increased over the past weeks. Less than a dozen states have gotten ahead of this virus, reads the analysis by the Harvard Global Health Institute. Overall, more than half of the U.S. is either reopened or planning to reopen in the coming weeks. Ashish Jha, director of the institute, told NPR the analysis is based on a model of future case counts by Youyang Gu, whose work is frequently cited by the White House. Based on that model, the U.S. needs to run more than 900,000 COVID tests per day, but the U.S. is running an average of 248,000 tests per day, according to the COVID Tracking Project. States with larger outbreaks need to do more testing. For example, New Jersey needs to run more than 98,000 tests a day by May 15th to reopen, but is currently running an average of 6,800 tests per day, according to the analysis. Jha noted that if social distancing requirements are relaxed, testing needs may grow because new cases are likely to increase. Even if a state has adequate testing, Jha added, it also needs to have enough contact tracing capabilities to spot and isolate new cases before reopening, otherwise new outbreaks could occur. States that have already allowed some businesses to reopen are not doing enough testing. For example, Georgia needs to run 26,000 tests per day to reopen by May 15th, but is running an average of 8,600 tests per day. In Texas, the state is running an average of 17,735 tests per day, but needs to run 27,282 tests per day by May 15th. Okay, well, for Ohio, Ohio has one of the lowest rates of testing among states. Our beloved Toledo Lucas County Health Department doesn't even know how many tests are even being performed in Lucas County. This is a problem for basic surveillance of this epidemic. Locally, we can't monitor the positivity rate of our testing. This could give us insight into whether we are casting the net wide enough in finding new infections with testing. We are missing a useful gauge in monitoring an epidemic that virtually everybody expects will grow with business reopenings and loosening social distancing. And to top this off for Ohioans, for some reason, Ohioans are less worried than other Americans about contracting COVID-19 amid business reopenings. This from WTOL. Ohioans less worried than rest of U.S. amid restaurant reopening, survey shows. A new survey shows that only a third of Ohioans are worried about contracting coronavirus as businesses across the state plan to open their doors. As businesses across Ohio are getting ready to reopen after Governor Mike DeWine's announcement, fears around coronavirus still linger. But those fears are a little bit lower in Ohio than in other parts of the country, according to a new survey. The survey from Inspire PR Group looked at consumer habits before, during, and after coronavirus restrictions across the country and found that just a third of Ohioans, compared to 41% of the rest of the country, are worried about contracting COVID-19. Overall, the conclusions were that customers are likely to return to restaurants when they reopen across the U.S., but around 20% less than before the pandemic. Higher-end restaurants, though, the survey said, will be more likely to get back to normal. Well, in Ohio, the reopenings are being rolled out. May 15th is the day that day spas, hair and nail salons, and barbershops can reopen. Restaurants and some bars will open in two phases, the first on May 15th with outdoor patios and the indoor areas on May 21st. Governor DeWine acknowledges that this will increase cases and deaths among Ohioans. My grade for Governor DeWine has slipped substantially with this unsubstantiated reopening and with a level of apparent care that is no more rigorous than the average state. Of course, most of them are also reopening while leapfrogging even the weak federal guidance. As an example, some states are using a customer density of 20 to 25% of maximum capacity for stores and or restaurants. Governor DeWine has chosen to use 50% of maximum occupancy. I find it hard to be convinced that public health is the primary consideration in Ohio's reopening of businesses. I'll give him a D for this reopening process, given the premature timing and lack of even relative rigor in what businesses reopen and what public health preventive practices are required, that is considered essential. Stay tuned, though. Maybe Governor DeWine will be a quick learner when cases, hospitalizations, and deaths inevitably rise. I am particularly concerned about hair and nail salons and barbershops. The close, sustained contact required for these services is high risk and ripe for transmission. Masks only confer limited protection, and aerosol transmission of the virus through extremely fine particles suspended in the air, which masks don't really protect from, is an emerging and growing concern. Masks work primarily through interrupting large particles spewing from an infected person. Aerosolized virus can be suspended in the air for long periods of time. Here's an article that gets to this a bit from Medical Express. Study finds breathing and talking contribute to COVID-19 spread. Current knowledge about the role of aerosols in the transmission of SARS-CoV-2 warrants urgent attention. Current guidance and public health information has slowly shifted focus towards aerosols as a transmission pathway, predominantly associated with breathing and talking by asymptomatic individuals. Providing guidelines for sufficient inhalation protection will be important in curbing the spread of COVID-19. The study, Consideration of the Aerosol Transmission for COVID-19 and Public Health, recently published in Risk Analysis, provides several lines of evidence for aerosol transmission, as well as recommendations for further research and public health communication. To date, the primary transmission methods of concern have been near-field transmission, that is coughing and sneezing, and hand-to-face transport from infected surfaces. More attention should be paid to the inhalation of aerosols, which are small particles that can remain airborne and are capable of short and long-range transport. On April 1, 2020, a letter produced by the National Academy of Sciences Committee on Emerging Infectious Diseases and 21st Century Health Threats concluded that even with limited research on SARS-CoV-2 specifically, quote, the results of available studies are consistent with the aerosolization of virus from normal breathing. Reports of asymptomatic individuals infecting others with COVID-19 reveals that activities such as normal breathing, talking, etc., produce small droplets that are capable of being transported, as healthy individuals are presumably not coughing or sneezing on a regular basis. Since the aerosol particles produced by talking and breathing are so small, they linger in the air for relatively long periods of time before gravity pulls them to the ground. This allows them to be transported over greater distances. A 2006 study of SARS-CoV-1 found that particles with a diameter of 1 to 3 micrometers remain suspended in the air almost indefinitely. Particles 10 micrometers in size took 17 minutes, and 20 micrometers took 4 minutes to fall to the ground. A recent laboratory study found that the virus can remain viable and infectious in aerosols for hours. It remained viable for the entire 3-hour duration of the study and on surfaces for up to days. And finding this a very interesting article, I looked up the original scientific article cited in this press report, and here's a lengthy quote on some findings reported in that article. Perhaps the one press report that drew the most attention in the United States to the possibility of asymptomatic transmission and the likelihood of an airborne aerosol form of active SARS-CoV-2 was the Skagit Valley Choral Rehearsal in Mount Vernon, Washington, that took place on March 10th. According to interviews with members present, the attendees were not symptomatic. They limited their physical contact and maintained distance from one another. The LA Times reported that after the 2.5-hour practice session, 45 of 60 members present tested positive or had symptoms of COVID-19. A co-author of a recent study that looked at survival time of the virus in aerosols suggested in the LA Times article that the forceful breathing action of singing may have increased dispersion of the virus at the church. Many other notable examples are mentioned often in the press. For example, that of a ski group in Ketchum, Idaho, where a group of about 700 seemingly healthy individuals gathered to ski. Reportedly, within a week, 126 people of that group showed symptoms of COVID-19. and from their recommendations. In the interest of curbing the spread of COVID-19, the currently available evidence strongly suggests the immediate need to address the significance of SARS-CoV-2 aerosol transmission. The weight of evidence suggests that sufficient inhalation protection could be important to curb COVID-19 and to refine guidance. Okay, folks, the bottom line here, masks do offer an important layer of protection, but they offer far from complete protection. Wearing masks wherever social distancing is not possible is sound advice, but it is no substitute for social distancing. Close sustained contact, even with cloth or surgical masks, is quite risky. To be perfectly clear, I am a strong advocate for mask usage whenever you cannot stay 6 feet away from others outside your household. The practical question, of course, comes down to questions such as, can you afford to stay 6 feet away from your stylist, barber, or manicurist and risk amateurish hair and nails? Well, folks, on that note, I'd like to switch perspectives to a much larger perspective in what may be the long game here. This from Bloomberg News. America has no plan for the worst-case scenario in COVID-19. In the midst of the constant up and down of coronavirus news, both from science and the markets, it's easy to lose sight of the scariest scenario of them all, the one where there's no magic bullet. In this entirely plausible situation, there would be no effective COVID-19 vaccine or transformative therapy. The combination of testing and contact tracing wouldn't successfully suppress the outbreak, and herd immunity would come, if at all, only after millions of deaths around the world. Even raising the possibility is a big downer, but the fact that an outcome is terrible doesn't make it impossible. Since the end of February, I've conducted some 20 interviews with epidemiologists and virologists like Mark Lipschick, Angela Rasmussen, and Carl Bergstrom, economists like Paul Romer, Stephanie Stancheva, and Larry Summers, and leaders at top hospitals and experts on government agencies whose names you may not know, but whose life work is preparing for moments like this one. Despite getting expert answers to dozens of my questions, the one question I haven't been able to get an answer for is this: who exactly is planning for the nightmare scenario in which we never get a vaccine or a breakthrough treatment? Ideally, it would be the federal government's executive branch with its resources and bird's eye view of the problem. But the president, running for re-election, has every reason to insist on unrealistic optimism. In fact, the administration actually discussed disbanding its coronavirus task force. The CDC and the other public health agencies might be a good second option, but they're busy rightly warning the public not to throw up their hands and let the virus spread unchecked. It's not really a job for scientists. They are, understandably, devoting all their energy to searching for treatments and vaccines. Governors only have the authority to plan for their individual states. And the Fed is tasked with trying to save jobs and markets, not modeling the end of the economy as we know it. I'm not one who enjoys doomsday scenarios. Yet, realism absolutely demands considering every confluence of events that could occur with reasonable probability. If, in fact, there is no agency or department planning for the worst-case scenario, that is a major governance failure. The fact that some 90 vaccines are being explored with some clinical trials is exciting and uplifting. It's better than 80 vaccines or 40 or 5 or none. The sheer number tends to make us think that one or several will succeed, but the sum of many very low probability events doesn't necessarily translate into a high probability that one will succeed. There's never been a successful mRNA vaccine like those being tested by Moderna and others brought to market after approval. Ditto for a viral vector vaccine like the one the Oxford University group is pursuing. And traditional vaccines classically take many years to get to patients. We've heard so many times that a vaccine will be available for 18 months that we may have started to confuse that message will not be available for 18 months, that we may have started to confuse that message for a very different idea that after 18 months, a vaccine will be available. Transformative therapies are similarly very far from guaranteed. In a preliminary study, remdesivir lowered mortality in hospitalized COVID-19 patients from 11.6% to 8%. That's statistically meaningful and could save lives, But even if broadly replicated, it won't mean a fundamental change in how we accept the risks of contracting the disease. And when was the last time you heard the word hydroxychloroquine? The combination of testing and contact tracing is being heralded as the mechanism for reopening the economy. The challenges here include the reality that testing on a massive scale is not available now and is unlikely to be available anytime soon. Manual contact tracing is only as good as the response rate and the willingness and capacity of contacting people to self-isolate. Digital contact tracing is new and raises challenging ethical questions, including around privacy. It too will work only if very large numbers of those who come in contact with infected people self-isolate. Then there's a little discussed question of whether testing plus contact tracing can actually be used to suppress a disease that has achieved community spread on a massive scale like the novel coronavirus. The combination is classically applicable in situations where there are a handful of cases and the disease is not yet spread widely. That was a situation in South Korea where it seems to have been highly effective. The technique is also said to have proven effective in the 2014 Ebola outbreak, but the epidemiologists have spoken that I have spoken to about the novel coronavirus have not been able to provide a truly comparable case where testing and contact tracing reigned in a disease that was this diffused across a huge geographical area. Usually, when all other scenarios have been discussed, the topic turns to herd immunity. But as Bergstrom has been arguing for weeks, in practice that likely means a huge percentage of the population being exposed to the virus. Depending on the true case fatality rate, that could mean many millions of deaths around the world. It's time to start thinking about how we should react to this horrible scenario. It isn't defeatism to ask what the world will look like if we lose the war we're fighting. It's realism. And in another reinforcement of persistent realities, this article from The Hill. Why the coronavirus pandemic is hitting the communities of color particularly hard. And this is a piece written by Rohan Arora, a youth environmental health activist and an inspiring physician leader advocate based out of Washington, D.C. His work and interests focus on the overlap of healthcare and community reform, specifically the reduction of health disparities for underserved communities. He is the founder of the organization The Community Checkup and has been working to alleviate environmental health disparities by bolstering civic engagement and promoting educational and outreach efforts. Okay, here we go. Amid the seemingly never-ending quarantine, we've been told that the coronavirus doesn't discriminate. National leaders are demanding people to stay in their homes because the virus will attack you with no regard to your economic status, political affiliation, social standing, faith, or any other differentiator. Yet, we are seeing a phenomenon that points to the very opposite conclusion. In Detroit, for instance, people of color are dying at an unprecedented rate. It seems that this virus is picking its victims based on the color of their skin. And Detroit is not alone. In fact, as of April 22nd, Chicago had reported 627 deaths due to COVID-19. Of these, roughly 80% of total deaths were from patients of color. This imbalance is not peculiar to Chicago or Detroit. We're seeing this disparity reflected throughout the United States. So why is this happening? Could persons of color be more susceptible to the virus than white Americans? The simple and most accurate answer is no. The only prejudice the virus shows is toward the vulnerable, the elderly, those with immune disorders, and those who are under extreme stress or exposed to the virus often. So that leads us to point the blame in a new direction, namely, the existing socioeconomic issues and healthcare problems persons of color in our country face. The existing socioeconomic issues in our country have led to persons of color becoming especially vulnerable. The pandemic is a symptom, not the cause. Persons of color, specifically brown and black Americans, are and have always been disproportionately impacted by health issues in our nation. The acuteness of the coronavirus pandemic is highlighting chronic societal problems that have affected us for many years, issues that have neither not been acted upon or where solutions have been inadequate. The fact is that of those 627 Chicagoan victims, nearly all of them had an underlying chronic condition, the most common of which are diabetes, hypertension, and lung disease. So this begs the question, why do so many people in our black and brown communities have these health issues? And what can and should be done to improve the situation? Lori Lightfoot, mayor of Chicago, said in an interview on CBS's Face the Nation that the underlying conditions suffered by people of color, particularly African Americans, had long plagued communities in her city and that these conditions led to life expectancy gaps. This virus attacks those underlying conditions with a vengeance. There were early warnings. Georges E. Benjamin of the American Public Health Association pointed out that evidence indicated that people over 65 with chronic illnesses would find it toughest. He argues, when you put that together with the understanding that in this country, you already have a black and brown population disproportionately affected by disparities in things like diabetes, heart disease, and asthma, we understand that if those populations got infected, they would be more at risk. In New Orleans, City Councilman Jay Banks also voiced concerns. This is unprecedented. This has been one of the hardest things I've had to do because you've got to get people to understand just how serious and devastating this thing is. The councilman is also chairman of New Orleans-based Mardi Gras Crew, which has lost 6 members to the pandemic. All over America, poor black communities have suffered from unemployment and access to health care for generations. This is why we're seeing such high rates of African-American patients. When you add to this fact that almost 10% more black workers are employed in essential roles, most of which are, quote, blue-collar jobs, than white people, you start to see where the problem is impounding. The insufficient access to proper health care, living around environmentally unsustainable infrastructure, little support in that area from employers, lack of nutritional education, and lower average income has resulted in higher rates of diabetes, heart disease, and pulmonary problems, precisely those things that make COVID-19 more deadly. Low income usually means living in higher densities of population, less access to proper health insurance, poorer diets, and fewer work-from-home options, precisely the criteria that allow a viral pandemic to take its toll on a population. The government can ask this population to be careful. In fact, it is easy for the government to suggest this population stay at home or practice social distancing, but the suggestions lack practicality and the damage has already been done. It's a compounding effect rooted in environmental health disparities. When you also consider environmental factors such as air and water quality, fundamentals to our well-being, you begin to understand why there is such a discrepancy. The world's wealthy often live in places where the air is clean and the water pure, while the poor end up clustered together in cheaply built, overcrowded accommodations with poor infrastructure. In modern America, the poor are largely, though by no means exclusively, racial minority groups. That legacy lives on. In 2010, the median income for black families was $39,715. That's down from $44,000 in 2000. But it is more complex than whether or not a black family has the financial stability to fund their health care. It appears that black people just don't get the same standard of health care as their fellow white citizens. The National Academy of Medicine, a nonprofit, non-governmental body, published a study that found that racial and ethnic minorities receive lower quality health care than white people, even when insurance status, income, age, and severity conditions are comparable. The National Academy of Medicine ends its reports with, some people in the United States were more likely to die from cancer, heart disease, and diabetes simply because of their race or ethnicity, not just because they lack access to health care. This is a statement that gives you chills. This is not a dystopian novel. This is the reality we face. The conclusion seems to be that health workers' biases are interfering, or more likely, the quality of health care available in built-up areas is of unsatisfactory quality. This begs the question, to what degree is this provider bias to blame? I find it hard to believe that the bulk of these disparities stem solely from provider bias. This may be the case, however, it can't be the reason for persons of color throughout the country dying at an unprecedented rate. There has to be something more significant. It is clear that the justification is nuanced. It isn't just provider bias that leads to these disparities. Rather, it is a combination of historical factors that have led to where we are today. Income disparities, environmental damage in communities of color, poor access to care, unsustainable infrastructure, and more has led to the continued mistreatment of persons of color. The color disparity, I call it. Most importantly, this disparity is leading and has already led to the deaths of countless people. Although a part of me understands that these historical injustices are to blame for the deaths in our country, the year is 2020. It isn't just the historical issues that are to blame for the color disparity. It's simple. People are dying due to our inaction. Could the pandemic be a wake-up call? There's a silver lining to the global pandemic, albeit a small one. While the government can't provide a quick fix, it can begin to work to vastly improve the situation. There must be enhancements to where and how people live and are educated to make a country where everyone is equal and where healthcare is not a lottery. If, at the same time, communities work within themselves, with other communities, and with the state and local government to improve their quality of life, to live better and more healthily, we will see the health and lives of those in our most impoverished communities improve. Most importantly, we'll see a decrease in the color disparity I addressed earlier. The young have a vital role to play in all this. We have the energy, the enthusiasm, and the determination to create change and are not hampered by the chains of the past. We can provide fuel through community outreach and civic engagement that will help empower all communities by providing a voice to the historically voiceless and understanding the nuanced nature of the color disparity. We can lead the way to a future of justice. We can act and we can save lives. Okay, well, in conjunction with that article, I found this one that I thought was perhaps most representative of racial health disparities and the racism that drives these disparities. This from The Hill. Native Health Center says it received body bags after it asked for supplies to fight coronavirus. The Seattle Indian Health Board, a community health center that services the Native American population in Seattle and King County in Washington State, said it received an order of body bags earlier this year when it asked for more medical supplies amid the novel coronavirus pandemic, NBC News reports. Esther Lucero, who serves as the center's chief executive officer, told the network that her team turned ghost white when the bags arrived in March. "We asked for tests, and they sent us a box of body bags," she said. Lucero said the body bags were sent by mistake from a distributor that meant to ship them to a local health department. The mix-up reportedly came just weeks after the center had also requested more supplies from the government agencies to help combat the ongoing pandemic. However, Abigail Echohawk, who is the chief research officer for the center, said in a statement to NBC News that the error is, quote, "a metaphor for what's happening amid the outbreak." The Navajo Nation is in crisis with cases, and there are tribes and other Indian organizations across the country that are in similar crises and can use medical supplies and help instead of watching people die, she said. Hospitals and clinics in a number of Native American communities are trying to grapple with a rise in coronavirus cases with a limited amount of resources and funding. The federal government reserved $8 billion in funding for Native American tribes during the pandemic, and the CARES Act passed in March. However, only a portion of that amount has been allocated so far amid an ongoing court battle over which groups should receive funding. Yikes. Okay, well, I want to repeat again what I've said before and others have said. I don't want to return to normal. I want something better than normal. Getting back to normal is not good enough. We need wider, broader societal justice to solve these underlying problems.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, sticking to the theme of things we should have done a long time ago, but maybe this crisis will give the opportunity to do a better job into the future. This from Kaiser Health News. Always the bridesmaid, public health rarely spotlighted until it's too late. The U.S. is in the midst of both a public health crisis and a healthcare crisis, yet most people aren't aware that these are two distinct things, and the response for each is going to be crucial. If you're not a health professional of some stripe, you might not realize that the nation's public health system operates in a large part separately from the system that provides most people's medical care. Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, a former deputy commissioner for the Food and Drug Administration and now vice dean at the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, distinguishes the healthcare system from the public health system as, quote, The difference between taking care of patients with COVID and preventing people from getting COVID in the first place. In general, the healthcare system cares for patients individually, while public health is about caring for an entire population. Public health includes many things a population takes for granted, like clean air, clean water, effective sanitation, food that is safe to eat, as well as injury prevention, vaccines, and other methods of ensuring the control of contagious and environmental diseases. In fact, it is public health, not advances in medical care, that has accounted for most of the increases in life expectancy during the past two centuries. Well before the advent of antibiotics and other 20th century medical interventions, public health activities around clean water, food safety, and safer housing led to enormous gains. It's pretty invisible if the public health system is working well, said Sharfstein, who also once served as Maryland's state health secretary. It's the dog that doesn't bark agency. But while public health isn't as flashy as a new drug or medical device or surgical procedure, it can simultaneously affect many more lives at once. Dr. Arthur Kellerman, a former emergency room physician and public health researcher at Emory University in Atlanta, told me, "I'm sure I saved more lives keeping George's motorcycle law in the books than all the trauma resuscitations I did." Still, because the public health system mostly operates in the background, it rarely gets the attention or funding it deserves. Until there's a crisis. Public health is a victim of its own success, said Jonathan Oberlander, a health policy researcher and professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. People can enjoy water, clean water and clean air, but don't always attribute it to public health, he said. We pay attention to public health when things go awry, but we tend to not pay a lot of attention in the normal course of events. Public health as a scientific field was created largely to address the sort of problem the world is now facing. Sharfstein noted that Baltimore established the nation's first public health department in 1793 to address a yellow fever epidemic. But between emergencies, the public health domain is largely ignored. In the U.S., 97 cents of every health dollar goes to medical care, he said. 3 cents goes to public health. It wasn't that long ago when rebuilding the nation's public health infrastructure was a top priority. In the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks and the anthrax attacks a month later, Congress devoted significant time, attention, and dollars to public health. Emerging from that flurry of activity from 2001 to 2004 was a bipartisan bill providing more than $4 billion to dramatically expand the nascent Strategic National Stockpile, to rebuild and modernize the capacity of state and local public health departments to deal with public health emergencies, and to further protect the nation's supply of drinking water from potential terrorist attacks. Also created during the period was Project BioShield, a federal program to provide incentives to private industry to develop vaccines and countermeasures for biological terror agents, as well as naturally occurring biological threats. But as the threat of biological terrorism seemed to wane, so did public health funding from Congress and the states. After accounting for inflation, funding for the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has decreased over the past decade, according to Trust for America's Health, a nonpartisan research and advocacy group. And while the Affordable Care Act established a public health fund worth $15 billion over 10 years, the Prevention and Public Health Fund, it has been repeatedly raided by both parties in Congress to pay for other, sometimes non-health items. For example, the fund was cut by more than $1 billion in 2018 to help cover the costs of a bipartisan budget bill. These choices on public health can come back to haunt us. Now, as the U.S. mourns the COVID-19 deaths of more than 76,000 people in less than 2 months, public health professionals again have the attention of policymakers. The question for them is how to best seize the moment. The trick is to put solutions that will work for a long time, said Sharfstein. It really matters how you handle a crisis because it might determine how you handle the next 50 or 60 years. The clock is ticking. Okay, well, I'd like to end the show on perhaps what would be some better news. 2020 Edelman Trust Barometer Spring Update, Trust and the COVID-19 Pandemic. The 2020 Edelman Trust Barometer Spring Update, Trust and the COVID-19 Pandemic reveals a remarkable shift in the landscape of trust since January. The spring update shows that amid the COVID-19 pandemic, government trust surged 11 points to an all-time high of 65%, making it the most trusted institution for the first time in our 20 years of study. Despite a 4-point increase in trust in business and several high-profile actions taken by companies and CEOs to help those in need, there is marked disappointment in how the private sector has performed during the crisis. This is a moment of reckoning for business, which must now deliver on the promise of stakeholder capitalism. A shift in trust. Government takes the lead. Since 2011, government has languished in distrust globally. The spring update shows a striking comeback for government at 65% trust, plus 11 points since January. The public is relying on government to protect them in a manner not seen since World War II. Trust in government is not only up by double digits in 6 of 11 markets surveyed, it is the only institution trusted by the mass population, 62%. During an unprecedented time when government response at all levels could mean the difference between life and death, the public is placing its faith in government to lead the fight against the virus. In fact, respondents want government out front in all areas of the pandemic response to provide economic relief, 86%, to get the country back to work, back to normal, 79%, to contain COVID-19, 73%, and to inform the public, 72%. Societal fears. Despite the high trust in government, the pandemic appears to have cast a spotlight on systemic inequity. The 2020 Edelman Trust Barometer in January showed that a growing sense of unfairness in the system was driving distrust across institutions. The spring update shows that 67% of respondents believe that those with less education, less money, and fewer resources are bearing a disproportionate burden of the suffering, risk of illness, and need to sacrifice in the pandemic. And more than half are very worried about long-term COVID-related job loss. Moment of reckoning for business. While business saw a 4-point uptick in trust to 62%, the pandemic has exposed several areas of deep concern. Half of people believe business is doing poorly, mediocre, or completely failing at putting people before profits. Only 43% believe that companies are protecting their employees sufficiently from COVID-19. And 46% do not believe business is helping smaller suppliers and business customers stay afloat. In addition, only 38% believe business is doing well or very well at putting people before profits. Only 39% believe business is doing well or very well at protecting their employees' financial well-being and safeguarding their jobs. And only 38% believe business is doing well or very well at helping their small suppliers and business customers stay in business by extending them credit or giving them more time to pay. The public wants to see vibrant partnerships between government and business in getting people back to work and revitalizing the economy. Health and safety is paramount. More than two-thirds of respondents, 67%, want saving lives prioritized over saving jobs. And 75% say CEOs should be cautious in getting their companies back to normal, even if it means waiting longer to reopen workplaces. Despite the twin health and economic crises, people are strikingly optimistic that long-term positive change will emerge. More than two-thirds of respondents say they believe the pandemic will result in valuable innovations and improvements in how we work, live, and treat each other. It's now up to institutions such as government, business, media, and non-governmental organizations to deliver on expectations and build a more resilient system for the future. And I would add, make it so. Okay, that does it for today's show. Thank you for joining me. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to re-listen to this show, pass along to somebody else, or queue up future shows, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.